This is the son of PCJ.
Hello, I'm Keith Parron, and welcome to the first edition of Focus Asia Pacific, a new weekly news magazine from PCJ Radio, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. Well, our goal on this program is to cover stories from this vast region that are not getting much coverage by most Western media outlets. The topics we will cover range from politics, social issues, business, and culture. The East Timorese government has raised concerns that it risks losing millions of dollars in revenue as a result of Australia's carbon tax. A price of $23 per ton of carbon dioxide emitted will be imposed on the 1st of July, might apply to companies operating in the oil and gas fields in the Timor Sea, which are jointly shared by both countries. The government in Dili says it is yet to receive formal details about the possibility of the additional cost from Canberra, and it would be unfair if the tax ended up eating into East Timor's revenue from the projects. Garish Sawalani has the story.
The dispute over the maritime boundary between Australia and East Timor has been a thorn in relations between the two countries. At the center of the dispute are oil and gas reserves at the bottom of the Timor Sea worth billions of dollars. For the moment at least, tensions have been pacified by revenue-sharing deals struck in 2002 and 2006. They range from a 90-10 ratio in favor of East Timor for gas fields such as Bayu Undan to a 50-50 arrangement for revenue from the Greater Sunrise field. But both countries are still at odds over the location of a natural gas processing plant in the Greater Sunrise field. East Timor wants the plant on its shores, while the Australian firm tasked with developing it, Woodside Petroleum, is seeking an offshore platform. Now a new dispute could be emerging as a result of the Australian government's carbon tax, which will be implemented on the 1st of July. The new legislation imposes a $23 per ton of carbon tax on many of the country's high-polluting industries, including the energy and resources sectors. And some of these companies are involved in the processing of natural gas and oil in the Timor Sea. Agreements between Canberra and Dili state that revenue will be split once costs are deducted. While the Australian government receives the revenue from the cost of the carbon tax, little is known about how East Timor will be affected. Greg Hunt is the Australian opposition's climate change spokesman. He says East Timor will lose millions of dollars in revenue.
The carbon tax hits East Timor, one of the poorest countries in the world, through the Bayu Undan field of the Timor Gap. The revenues are shared jointly. East Timor gets the majority. And the government has imposed a carbon tax on this field, but it doesn't pay it itself because it simply shuffles money between one source of Australian revenue and another. East Timor, however, is likely to be hit for millions and millions of dollars of carbon tax each year, every year, for the life of the field. So one of the poorest countries in the world will be subsidising one of the wealthiest countries, Australia.
In a statement, a spokeswoman for Australia's climate change minister, Greg Combe, says the government in Canberra will consult with East Timor about any application of the carbon price within the joint petroleum development area and will ensure that any arrangements reflect Australia's obligations under international law. Alfredo Pires is East Timor's State Secretary for Natural Resources. He says there's been no formal agreement between Dili and Canberra over the carbon tax.
The latest legal advice that I've been getting from my technical people is that any agreement and these things need to be discussed. So if there's such an agreement in black and white, I would like to see it. These are not small issues that you can decide that unilaterally. It needs to go through it. There are big implications. But equally, I mean, I understand Australia needs to have an environmental piece of legislation, but you need to really consider before moving into areas that's not totally of the sovereignty of Australia.
He says it would be unfair if East Timor faced additional costs as a result of the new tax.
We will be very concerned about any additional costs that may have to upon the country. But we need to look at the exact figures there. But right now, our, as Secretary of State and as part of the government, our main concern is about the applicability of the legislation. But right now, we would like to keep things as it is until we have further discussions for us to analyze, see if there's any benefits. But you've got to bear in mind that these are two countries, neighbors, but we're very different in terms of our economical development. And definitely anything that gives any additional cost to this little country will be seen as unfair.
Mr. Pires says as a small nation, East Timor's contribution to global carbon emissions is insignificant when compared to Australia.
So I don't think we've been responsible for, as a small country, near country, this environmental damage is mainly done by a lot of industrial nations. So we'll consider very carefully whether we're going to go down the line of paying anything at all.
A group of Sri Lankan academics have staged a protest in Colombo over the government's failure to make education a priority in the nation. The Federation of University Teachers Association says the country does not value its intellectuals, who are essential for the country's development, and as a result, academic staff are leaving for greener pastures overseas. Radio Australia's Liam Cochran speaks to the senior lecturer at the Open University in Sri Lanka, Nalin Abesekari.
Here, like in 26th of April, like over 1,000 academics in Sri Lanka, they join hands. Actually, like because of the demands not being fulfilled by the government.
So can you tell us about these demands? What is it that the government promised to do?
Yeah, basically the number one is, so we, like last 2-3 years, there were some problems for the salary abnormalities, where the immediate implementation of the salary step outlined in the interim proposal of the 7th July 2011, with steps that should have been implemented in 2012 budget, has been not fulfilled by the government. So that might be the number one. But most importantly, for Sri Lankan education, if you're talking about the history, most of the time, average like 5-6% being allocated from the GDP. But last 2-3 years, only 2% of the GDP is allocated for the education sector and the higher education. So now, like, there's a small demand from the university academics just to increase this at least to 6% within next 2 years. Plus, take academics as a special category of service personnel based on the crucial role they have played in the developing the country. So these are the few demands actually adopted by the University Teachers Association.
Okay, well let's talk about the salary demand. Can you give us an idea of what a university lecturer earns as their salary compared to other professions?
Yeah, basically Sri Lanka is really talking about the public sector and the private sector. So in the private sector, where there is a kind of a different categories of salary scales. But if you're really comparing about the salaries of university lecturers, one good example for a senior lecturer, once he passes his master's, once he just goes through his PhDs, is still they are getting an average salary of like 75,000 LKR. But if you're talking about the private sector in Sri Lanka, basically if you're talking about the salary of the one given person, sometimes this 75,000 equal to the petrol allowance of some executives.
Just the petrol allowance is the same as the entire salary for the academics.
Yes, exactly. But as a principle, this government has agreed for the grievances of the university lecturers, but there's a problem of not implementing that in a proper way. So it has been agreed by the government also. So there were a series of meetings going on, but the thing is not implementing the accepted grievances by the government.
Why do you think the government hasn't implemented the promises? Do you think it's because they simply don't have the money or they don't want to?
No, actually, there are some problems of the economy of the country at the moment. So we have the growth rate more than 8% of the country. Now we can see the tourism, the particular development of the country also happening. But there might be some problems for, say, like the depreciation of the US dollar. So And also the economic problems, like there are some currencies like being devaluated in Sri Lanka. And also the government is finding very difficult because the government is already doing some development work in the north and east. So there are some financial problems for the government, as well as there are some series of discussions going on with the Federation of University Teachers Association and the government. But simply sometimes we can see there are some appointment of some committees. These things are going on, but it's not really implementing for the university lecturers.
Okay, so you've had this protest on the 26th of April with around 1,000 academics getting together to put forward your displeasure over this. What is the next step for your organisation?
Yeah, this organisation, like Federation of University Teachers Association, already like we are looking for, like as a university, as a union, looking for the agreements with the government. So there will be some series of discussions, and also there's a humble demand from the university lecturers. Now in Sri Lanka, we had only like 2 years back, it was like 5,000. Now 500 has been migrated. If you go to whatever the countries, you can see the university lecturers, Sri Lankan university lecturers. If you go to even Melbourne University, we can see in Swinburne, you have some lecturers. So the people are going, people are migrating because they have been not respected in terms of salary, because like cost of living in this country has always increasing. So there should be something for them to just talk about the dignity of the people, especially for the intellectuals.
Staying in Sri Lanka, a group of Buddhist monks in central Sri Lanka have threatened to demolish a mosque in the sacred area of Dambulla in central Sri Lanka. The Prime Minister has backed the monks, ordering the mosque's removal. It raises concerns that the government is pushing a nationalist Sinhalese agenda to divert attention away from the country's troubled economy ahead of the next election. Kara Douglas has the story.
Tensions between some members of the Buddhist and Muslim communities in central Sri Lanka came to a head when about 2,000 Buddhists, including monks, marched to the Dambulla Mosque last week demanding its demolition. The mosque was later firebombed. Prayers were cancelled, but no one was hurt.
This threat to demolish the mosque by a group of very arch conservative monks is something concerning all right-minded people in the country. And unless the government acts soon on this, it's going to escalate.
Dr. Amir Ali is vice president of the Regional Islamic Council of Southeast Asia and the Pacific. The Sri Lankan expat and Murdoch University academic believes the attack on the Dambulla Mosque is part of a wider trend.
There is a small group of people who are very fanatic, and they are claiming that the whole country belongs to the Buddhists and that no other community has a legitimate right to exist in the country. The government should put its foot down and tell these monks that's not the way it's going to be. It's a plural society, and every community, every religion, every icons must be respected.
The Sri Lankan Prime Minister, D.M. Jayaratne, has ordered the mosque's removal, claiming it's an illegal building. But mosque officials say it's been there for more than 50 years, well before the area was declared a sacred zone 20 years ago. The Sri Lankan opposition MP, Lakshman Kwila, has accused the government of supporting extremists.
This is not Buddhist activity, these are fascists.
Mr. Kwila says if the mosque was built illegally, the government should resolve the issue in court.
The government must go through the papers and first see whether this construction is an illegal one. And if it is so, then they must file papers in court. You can't take the law into your own hands.
While most of Sri Lanka's Sinhalese majority are Buddhists, Muslims are regarded as the third ethnic group after the mainly Hindu Tamils. Dr. Jahan Pereira from Sri Lanka's National Peace Council believes the government is promoting a Sinhalese nationalist agenda to divert attention away from the country's economic woes.
The government distracts the people with Sinhala nationalism, and that gives space to extremist groups among the Sinhalese people. It are small because they don't do very well in elections, especially when they are not allied to the government. If they contest by themselves, they get less than 5% of the vote. But it gives these Sinhalese extremist groups a special power so that they have a certain license to do what they want and get away with it.
Dr. Amir Ali says Muslims also believe the government's motivation is political.
They are facing elections very soon, so they want to divert the attention of the Buddhist community from the economic difficulties the country is facing. Economically, the country is in serious trouble.
So they want to divert the attention on the issues like religion so that they can win the support.
The Sri Lankan Prime Minister issued a statement saying the removal of the Dambulla Mosque has the support of local Muslim MPs. But they've rejected the claim. Dr. Jahan Pereira says the government risks losing the support of the Muslim community.
They're putting a lot of pressure on the Muslim politicians who are in alliance with the government, who are part of the government, to take action. Unless the government takes some sort of remedial action, the government is going to have to pay a price because its support base among the Muslims who have been supportive of this government by and large is going to erode.
Dr. Amir Ali says the issue could have a broader impact on peace in Sri Lanka just 3 years after the end of the civil war.
It is a concern because we thought after the victory, the Buddhist, the majority community will be magnanimous and they will approach the minority communities and solve their problems amicably and have serious negotiations. But that is not happening.
Sri Lanka's Muslim community has typically shied away from confrontations with the government. But Dr. Ali says the situation at the Dambulla Mosque should concern all Sri Lankans.
I think the Tamils, the Muslims, or the Christians, the Muslims, the Hindus, and the neutral Buddhists must join together and raise their voice against this policy of the government and make them not to promote this sort of fanatical situation in the country.
And this is Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio. India now has become the world's biggest arms importer, replacing its neighbor China in the top slot as it works towards replacing its aging military hardware. But corruption scams plaguing the defense forces involving middlemen in the procurement process are a serious cause for concern. Murari Krishnan reports.
When Army Chief General V.K. Singh shocked the country with the startling revelation late last month that he was offered a $2.73 million bribe to accept the purchase of 600 substandard vehicles, it drove the Defense Ministry into a tizzy. It forced the government to institute a high level of inquiry by the Central Bureau of Investigation if a backhander was offered by a lobbyist. But if that was not enough, just last week, Defense Minister A.K. Antony ordered a fresh inquiry into allegations of embezzlement in the procurement of 12 helicopters for the VVIP communication squadrons of the Indian Air Force from an Italian firm worth $788 million. The role of middlemen in defense deals has been the subject of intense debate in India for years now and has once again revealed the dilemma faced by the government. Josie Joseph, a defense analyst, has been chronicling this sector for over a decade, explains why.
India right now imports 70% of its defense needs. It sources just 30% from indigenous sources. One of the reasons why arms dealers are flourishing in this country is because India is heavily dependent on foreign supplies.
The presence of procurement agents has troubled several governments, particularly after the Bofors Howitzer bribery scandal surfaced over a quarter century ago. Since then, authorities have tried to fine-tune the country's cumbersome procurement system, which causes huge time delays. Saurabh Joshi, strategic analyst and editor, StratPost, on South Asia's military and strategic affairs, says there needs a major overhaul.
They're not going anywhere. It's a reality of the industry that commission agents do facilitate these sorts of business dealings. There have been attempts to regulate this sort of profession earlier. In fact, the Ministry of Defense had some years back had set up a scheme for registration of these agents. This requires a restructuring of the defense procurement system as such.
A recent report states that India's strong and dynamic growth in military spending will continue through the next decade as the government seeks to fulfill its ambitious defense modernization plans. The government plans to spend about $50 billion over the next 5 years to upgrade its military. In the latest budget, the government raised defense expenditure, a rise of nearly 18% over the previous year's outlays, one of the highest increases in recent years. This, some say, could be interpreted as an open invitation to backroom deals. Sanjay Srivastav, a sociologist, sounds a note of caution.
Specifically because in India, the defense sector has been held up as the bulwark against, you know, everything that's gone wrong in this country. It seems to be particularly crucial that the government pay particular attention to this, because ultimately what happens in the defense sector also affects our sense of what happens in the civil sector as well. It is particularly important that we make sure that our historically imagined honest defense sector continues to be so.
From preparation to the tender document to evaluation and final selection, arms dealers try at every stage to manipulate to suit the firms they represent. Mr. Joseph believes there could still be time off before their role could be legit.
India has a very skewed policy of just banning middlemen. But maybe at a point of time when India begins to source its defense needs from domestic companies, at that point of time maybe India could look at legalizing middlemen with very strict rules like the way it exists in a lot of other countries.
Mr. Joshi also agrees.
Really, this industry depends a lot on commission agents. Unless you set up a robust system for regulating this business of commission agents, it's just going to breed more and more scandals.
With big ticket defense deals in the offing, there is pressure to see that the government ensures efficient and corruption-free procurement guidelines for acquiring military goods.
This is PCJ Radio on 88.2 FM. This is PCJ Radio on 107.5 FM in Nairobi, Kenya. And nationwide on 5. This is PCJ Radio on KBCT in Waco, Texas. This is PCJ Radio on 9955 kilohertz to Latin America. This is PCJ Radio on 7590 kilohertz DRM. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is PCJ Radio.
A predominant Cambodian human rights group has disputed the military's account of an alleged murder-suicide involving a military officer and a high-profile activist. Officials say the Cambodian military police officer in Rotana shot himself twice in the chest after gunning down an anti-lodging campaigner, Chut Vati, in Kokang province last Thursday. Local human rights group Liu Kadho has been documenting the events and say it is not possible that In Rotana could have shot himself. The group says the government committee that is being set up to investigate the killings must remain independent of the military, adding that the case is just the latest example of escalating violence towards human rights and labor activists in Cambodia. Joanna McCarthy has the story.
Cambodian activist Chut Vati was a vocal and high-profile opponent of illegal logging and land acquisition. On Thursday, he was documenting logging activities in Kokang along with two women journalists. A confrontation reportedly broke out with military police as they tried to take his camera's memory card. Military officials say one of the officers, In Rotana, fatally shot Chut Vati and, quote, when he realised he'd made a mistake and could not flee from the law, he decided to kill himself.
We don't know who murdered both men, but it's we dispute and challenge the government's claims that it was a suicide or that the bullets ricocheted and killed the military police. That's not possible.
Nali Palorge is the director of local human rights group Lakado. Her organisation has been on the ground of the site of the events and says the official version can't be true.
Primarily because they removed two bullets from the In Rotana, the military police. The bullets were around his chest area, so it's very difficult for, it's impossible for someone to shoot themselves twice in that area. So that would be disputable.
Nali Palorge says the government has announced that a ministerial committee will investigate the events. And she says it's important that it remains at arm's length from the military.
It would not be independent or credible if the military police did the investigation. It's really important that the police at the national level does an investigation to give it some distance. We hope that this committee will not involve the military police. We hope that it's the police and different institutions to ensure that there's more independence.
Liccardo says it's documented 6 separate cases since November last year where military police and soldiers have shot and injured activists. Only in one of those cases has anyone been arrested. Human rights groups have long complained of a culture of impunity in Cambodia, and they say there's been a surge in violence towards protesters involved in land and labour disputes. Meanwhile, friends and associates of Chut Phut Thi are mourning his death. Sarah Milne is a postdoctoral fellow at the Australian National University, and she specialises in community-based conservation schemes in Indonesia and Cambodia. She spent time with Chut Phut Thi only recently and says he was aware of the dangers of being an activist in Cambodia.
We didn't talk about it explicitly, but it was implicit. It was there. We knew that he was really up against some very dark and powerful forces. And the last time that I saw him, a week before he was killed, he squeezed my hand quite tightly and it was almost as though it was a message of, I may not see you again. Maybe he knew.
What are you hoping will be his legacy?
I really hope that people don't forget his courage and that they are not intimidated and they're not too afraid to stand up and confront what's happening in Cambodia. It's terrifying what's happening there, and it's understandable for people to retreat, but it's a very critical moment in Cambodia's history.
And with that report from Joanna McCarthy, we've come to the end of this first edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us, our email address is very simple, pcj@pcjmedia.com. Once again, pcj@pcjmedia.com. We also invite you to visit the website for Focus Asia Pacific at www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. Once again, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP, where you can listen to this program again, as well as all past editions. Well, those past editions are coming up very soon, so do check it out. A special thank you goes to Radio Australia and Radio New Zealand International for some of the material used today. So on behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell wishing you well. So long, everyone.